color. Your hair's going brown again, too. Ow! Ponder slumped to his knees. It was like wearing a lead suit. I never want to go through that again. Suicide's your best bet, then, said Ridcully. Is this going to happen again? Probably. At least once, anyway. Ponder got to his feet with a steely look in his eyes. Then let's find out whoever's building this place and ask them to send us home, he growled. They might not want to listen, said Ridcully. Deities can be touchy. Ponder shook his sleeves to leave his hands free. For a wizard, this was the equivalent to checking the functioning of a pump-action shotgun. Then we'll insist, he said. Really, Stibbons? Oh, what about protection of the magical ecology? Ponder turned on him a look that would have opened a strongroom. Ridcully was in his 70s and spry even for wizards, who tended to live well into their second century if they survived their first 50 years. Ponder wasn't sure how old he'd been, but he definitely thought he could hear a blade being sharpened. It was one thing to know you were on a journey, and quite another to see your destination on the horizon. It can get stuffed, he said. It would be nice to say that this experience taught Ponder a valuable lesson, and that he was a lot more considerate towards old people afterwards. And this was true for about 5 minutes. Well thought out, Mr. Stibbons. I can see we'll make a wizard of you yet. Ah, the Dean's... Oh. The Dean's clothes billowed up, but did not, as it were, inflate to their old size. The hat, in particular, was big enough to rock on the Dean's ears, which were redder, and stuck out more than Ponder remembered. Ridcully raised the hat.
Push off, Grandad, said the Dean.
Ah, said the Arch-Chancellor. 13 years old, I'd say, which explains a lot. Well, Dean, help us with the others, will you?
Why should I?
The adolescent Dean cracked his knuckles.
Ah, I'm young again, and soon you'll be dead. I've got me whole life ahead of me.
Firstly, you'll spend it here. And secondly, Dean, you think it's going to be jolly good fun being the Dean in a 13-year-old body, don't you? But within a minute or two, you'll start forgetting it all, you see? The old temporal gland can't allow you to remember being 14 when you're not even 13 yet. You follow me? You'd know this stuff, Dean, if you weren't forgetting. You'll have to go through it all over again, Dean. The brain has far less control over the body than the body does over the brain, and adolescence is not a good time. Nor is old age, for that matter, but at least the spots have cleared up. Some of the more troublesome glands have settled down, and you're allowed to take a nap in the afternoons and twinkle at young women. In any case, the Dean's body hadn't experienced too much old age yet, whereas every junior spot, ache and twinge was firmly embossed on the morphic memory. Once, it decided, was enough. The Dean expanded. Ponder noticed that his head in particular swelled up to fit his ears. The Dean rubbed his spot-free face. 5 minutes wouldn't have been bad, he complained. What was that all about? Temporal uncertainty, said Ridcully. You've seen it before, didn't you realize? What were you thinking of?
Sex.
Oh, yes, of course. Silly of me, really. Ridcully looked along the deserted beach. Mr. Stibbons thinks we can... He began, ye gods, there are people here. A young woman was walking towards them, swaying anyway. My word, said the Dean. I suppose this isn't slacky by any chance. I thought they wore grass skirts, said Ridcully. What's she wearing, Stibbons?
A sarong.
Looks right enough to me, said the Dean. Certainly makes a man wish he was 50 years younger, said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. 5 minutes younger would do for me, said the Dean. Incidentally, did any of you notice that rather clever inadvertent joke just then? Stibbons said it was a sarong, and I said... What's that she's carrying? Said Ridcully. No, listen, you see, I misheard him, in fact, and I...
Looks like coconuts, said Ponder, shading his eyes. This is a bit more like it, said the Senior Wrangler. Because actually, I thought he said, it's wrong, you see?
Certainly a coconut, said Ridcully. I'm not complaining, of course, but aren't these sultry maids generally black-haired? Red doesn't seem very typical. So, I said, I suppose you get coconut here, said the lecturer in recent rooms. They float, don't they? And listen, when Stibbons said sarong, I thought... Something... Familiar about her, Ridcully mused.
Did you see that nut in the Museum of Quite Unusual Things, said the senior wrangler, called the Coco de Mer, and, he permitted himself, very curious shape, you know. You'll never guess who it used to put me in mind of. It can't be Mrs. Whitlow, can it? Said Ponder. As a matter of fact, I must admit that it... Well, I thought it was mildly amusing anyway, said the Dean. It is Mrs. Whitlow, said Ridcully. More of a nut, really, but... It dawned on the senior wrangler that the sky was a different colour on his personal planet. He turned round, looked, said, "Moo," and fell gently to the sand. "He don't quite know what's happened to Mr. Librarian," said Mrs. Whitlow in a voice that made the senior wrangler twitch, even in his swoon. The coconut opened its eyes. It looked as if it had just seen something truly horrific, but this is a normal expression for baby orangutans, and in any case, it was looking at the Dean.
"Eek,"
it said. Ridcully coughed. "Well, at least he's the right shape," he said. "And, you, Mrs. Whitlow, how do you feel?"
Said the senior wrangler.
"Very well indeed, thank you," said Mrs. Whitlow. "This country agrees with me. I don't know whether it was the swim, but I haven't felt quite so buoyant in years. But I looked around, and there was this dear little ape just sitting there."
"Ponder, would you mind just throwing the senior wrangler in the sea for a moment?" said Ridcully. "Nowhere too deep. Don't worry if it steams." He took Mrs. Whitlow's spare hand. "I don't want to worry you, dear Mrs. Whitlow," he said, "but I think something is shortly going to come as a bit of a shock to you. First of all, and please don't misunderstand me, it might be a good idea to loosen your clothing." He swallowed. "Slightly."
The bursar had experienced some changes of age as he wandered through the wet but barren land, but to a man capable of being a vase of flowers for an entire afternoon, this was barely a mild distraction. What had caught his eye was a fire. It was burning bits of driftwood, and the flames were edged with blue from the salt. Close to it was a sack made of some sort of animal skins. The damp earth beside the bursar stirred, and a tree erupted, growing so fast that the rain steamed off the unfolding leaves. This did not surprise him. Few things did. Besides, he'd never seen a tree growing before, so he did not know how fast it was supposed to go. Then several more trees exploded around him. One grew so fast that it went all the way from sapling to half-rotten trunk in a few seconds. And it seemed to the bursar that there were other people here. He couldn't see them or hear them, but something in his bones sensed them. However, the bursar was also quite accustomed to the presence of people who couldn't be seen or heard by anyone else, and had spent many a pleasant hour in conversation with historical figures, and sometimes the wall. All in all, the bursar was, depending on your outlook, the most or least suitable person to encounter deity on a first-hand basis. An old man walked around a rock and was halfway to the fire before he noticed the wizard. Like Rincewind, the bursar had no room in his head for racism. As a skin colour, black came as quite a relief compared to some of the colours he'd seen, although he'd never seen anyone quite so black as the man now staring at him. At least the bursar assumed he was staring. The eyes were so deep set that he couldn't be sure. The bursar, who had been properly brought up, said, "Hooray! There's a rosebush!" The old man gave him a rather puzzled nod. He walked over to the dead tree and pulled off a branch, which he pushed into the fire. Then he sat down and watched it, as though watching wood char was the most engrossing thing in the world. The bursar sat down on a rock and waited. If the game was patience, then two could play at it. The old man kept glancing up at him. The bursar kept smiling. Once or twice he gave the man a little wave. Finally, the burning branch was pulled out of the fire. The old man picked up the leather sack in his other hand and walked off among the rocks. The bursar followed him. There was an overhang here under a small cliff, shielding a stretch of vertical rock from the rain. It was the kind of tempting surface that would, in Ankh-Morpork, have already been covered so thickly with so many posters, signs, and graffiti that if you'd removed the wall, the general accretion would still have stood up. Someone had drawn a tree. It was the simplest drawing of a tree the bursar had ever seen since he'd been old enough to read books that weren't mainly pictures. But it was also in some strange way the most accurate. It was simple because something complex had been rolled up small, as if someone had drawn trees and started with the normal green cloud on a stick and refined it and refined it some more and looked for the little twists in a line that said tree and refined those until there was just one line that said tree. And now when you looked at it, you could hear the wind in the branches. The old man reached down beside him and took up a flat stone with some white paste on it. He drew another line on the rock, slightly like a flattened V, and smeared it with mud. The bursar burst out laughing as the wings emerged from the painting and whirred past him. And again he was aware of a strange effect in the air. It reminded him of, yes, old Rubber Hauser. That was his name, dead now, of course, but remembered by many of his contemporaries as the inventor of the graphical device. The bursar had joined the university when likely wizards started their training early, somewhere after the point where they learned to walk, but before they started to push over girls in the playground. The writing of lines in detention class was a familiar punishment, and the bursar, like everyone else, toyed with the usual practice of tying several pens to a ruler in a group attempt to write lines in threes. But Hauser, a reflective sort of boy, had scrounged some bits of wood and stripped a mattress of its springs and devised the 4, 16, and eventually the 32-line writing machine. It had got so popular that boys were actually breaking rules in order to have a go on it, at threepence a time to use it, and a penny to help wind it up. Of course, more time was spent setting it up than was ever saved by using it, but this is the case in many similar fields, and is a sign of progress. The experiments tragically came to an end when someone opened a door at the wrong moment, and the entire pent-up force of Hauser's experimental prototype 256-line machine propelled him backwards out of a fourth-floor window. Except for the absence of screams, the hand tracing its infinitely simple lines on the rock brought back memories of Hauser. There was a sense of something small being done that was making something happen that was huge. He sat and watched. It was, he remembered later, whenever he was in a state to remember anything, one of the happiest times of his life. When Rincewind lifted his head, a watchman's helmet was spinning gently on the ground. To his amazement, the men themselves were still there, although they were lying around in various attitudes of unconsciousness, or at least, if they had sense, feigned unconsciousness. The luggage had a cat's tendency to lose interest in things that didn't fight back, even after you'd kicked them a few times. Shoes littered the ground, too. The luggage was limping around in a circle. Rincewind sighed and stood up. "Take the shoes off, they don't suit you," he said. The luggage stood still for a moment, and then the rest of the shoes clattered against the wall. And the dress. What would those nice ladies think if they saw you dressing up like this? The luggage shrugged off the few sequined tatters that remained. "Turn around, I want to see your handles." "No, I said turn around." "Turn around properly, please." "Eh, I thought so." "I said turn around. Those earrings, they don't do anything for you at all, you know." He leaned closer. "Is that a stud? Have you had your lid pierced?" The luggage backed away. Its manner indicated very clearly that while it might give in on the shoes, the dress, and even the earrings, the battle over the stud would go to the finish. "Well, all right. Now give me my clean underwear. You could make shelves out of the stuff I'm wearing." The luggage opened its lid. "Good. Now I... Is that my underwear? Would I be seen dead in something like that?" "Yes. As a matter of fact, I suspect I would." "My underwear, please. It's got my name inside, although I must admit I can't quite remember why I thought that was necessary." The lid shut. The lid opened. "Thank you." It was no use wondering how it was done, or for that matter why the laundry returned freshly ironed. The watchman was still very wisely remaining unconscious, but out of habit Rincewind went behind a stack of old boxes to change. He was the sort of person who'd go behind a tree to change if he was on a desert island all alone. "You notice something odd about this alley?" he said over the top of the boxes. "There are no drain pipes. There's no gutters. They've never heard of rain here. I suppose you are the luggage, aren't you? And not some kangaroo in disguise. Why am I asking? Ye gods, these feel good. Right, let's go." The luggage opened its lid again, and a young woman looked up at Rincewind. "Who are you?" "Oh, you're the blind man," she said. I beg your pardon?
Sorry, Darlene said you must be blind. Well, actually, she said you must be bloody blind. Can you give me a hand out?
It dawned on Rincewind that the girl clambering out of the luggage was Neelette, the third member of Letitia's crew, and the one who'd seemed quite plain compared to the others, and certainly a lot less, well, noisy wasn't quite the word. Probably the word was expansive. They filled the space around them to capacity. Take Darlene, a lady he'd last seen holding a man daintily by the collar so that she could punch him in the face. When she walked into a room, there'd be no one in it unaware that she'd done so. Neelette was just ordinary. She brushed some dirt off her dress and sighed. I could see there was going to be another fight, so I hid in Trunky, she said.
Trunky, eh? Said Rincewind.
The luggage had the decency to look embarrassed.
Sooner or later, there's always a fight where Darlene goes, said Neelette. You'd be amazed the things she can do with a stiletto heel.
I think I've seen one of them, said Rincewind. Don't tell me the others. Can I help you? Only me and Trunky here, he gave the luggage a kick, we're heading off, weren't we, Trunky?
Oh, no, don't kick her. She's been so useful, said Neelette.
Really? Said Rincewind.
The luggage turned round slowly so that he couldn't see the expression on its lock.
Oh, yeah.
I reckon the miners in Kangoolie would have been very unpleasant to Letitia if Trunky hadn't stepped in.
Stepped on, I expect.
How do you know that?
Oh, the luggage... Trunky is mine. We got separated.
Neelette tried to arrange her hair.
It's all right for the others, she said. They just have to change wigs.
Beer might be a good shampoo, but not when it's still in the tinny, she sighed.
Oh, well, I suppose I'll have to find a way home now.
Where do you live?
Warralora Surfer.
It's Rimwoods, she sighed again.
Back to life in the banana bending factory. So much for show business.
Then she burst into tears and sat down heavily on the luggage. Rincewind didn't know whether he should go into the pat-pat-there-there routine. If she was like Darlene, he might lose an arm. He made what he hoped was a soothing yet non-aggressive mumble.
I mean, I know I can't sing very well, and I can't dance, but frankly neither can Letitia and Darlene. When Darlene sings Prancing Queen, you could slice bread with it. Not that they've been unkind, she added quickly, polite even in the throes of woe. But really, there's got to be more to life than getting beer thrown at you every night and being chased out of town.
Rincewind felt confident enough to venture a there-there. He didn't risk a pat-pat.
Really, I only did it because of Noeline dropping out,
Neelette sobbed.
And I'm about the same height, and Letitia couldn't find anyone else in time, and I needed the money, and she said it would be okay, provided people didn't notice my hands were so small.
Noeline being...
My brother. I told him, trying for the surf championship is fine, and ball gowns are fine, but both together, I don't think so. Did you know what a nasty rash you can get from being rolled across coral? And next morning, Letitia had this tour organised, and, well, it seemed a good idea at the time.
Noeline, Rincewind mused. That's an unusual name for,
Darlene said you wouldn't understand.
Neelette stared into the middle distance.
I think my brother worked in the factory too long, she mused. He was always very impressionable. Anyway,
Oh, I get it. He's a female impersonator, said Rincewind.
Oh, I know about those. Old pantomime tradition. Couple of balloons, a straw wig, and a few grubby jokes. Why, when I was a student at Hogswatch parties, old Farter Carter and Really Pants would put on a turn where...
He was aware that she was giving him one of those long, slow looks.
Tell me, she said, do you get about much?
You'd be amazed, said Rincewind.
And you meet all kinds of people?
Generally the nastier kind, I have to admit.
Well,
some men... Neelette stopped.
Really, Pants? That was someone's name?
Not exactly. He was called Ronald Pants. So, of course, when anyone heard that, they said...
Oh, is that all? Said Neelette.
She stood up and blew her nose.
I told the others I'd leave when we got to the Galar, so they'll understand. Being a female impersonator is no job for a woman, which is what I am, incidentally. I hoped it was obvious, but in your case I thought I'd better mention it. Can you get us out of here, Trunky?
The luggage wandered over to the wall at the end of the alley and kicked it until there was a decent-sized hole. On the way back, it clogged a watchman who was unwise enough to stir.
I call him the luggage, said Rincewind, helplessly.
Really? We call her Trunky.
The wall opened up into a dark room. Crates were packed against the walls, covered with cobwebs.
Oh, we're in the old brewery, said Neelette. Well, the new one, really. Let's find a door.
Good idea, said Rincewind, eyeing the spiderwebs. New brewery? Looks pretty old to me.
Neelette rattled a door. Locked, she said.
Come on, we'll find another one. Look, it's the new brewery, because we built it to replace the one over the river. But it never worked. The beer went flat or something. They all said it was haunted. Everyone knows that, don't they? We went back to the old brewery. Dad lost nearly all his money.
Why?
He owned it. Just about broke his heart, that did. He left it to me.
She tried another door.
Because, well, he never got on with Nolene. Well, with the, or rather, obviously you don't. But it ruined the business, really. And Rue Beer used to be the best there was.
Can't you sell it? The site, I mean?
Here? A place where beer goes flat within 5 seconds? Can't give it away.
Rincewind peered up at the big metal vats.
Perhaps it was built on some old religious site, he said. That sort of thing can happen, you know. Back home there was this fish restaurant that got built on a...
Neelette rattled another unbudging door.
That's what everyone thought, she said. But apparently, Dad asked all the local tribes, and they said it wasn't. They said it wasn't any kind of sacred site. They said it was an unsacred site. Some chief went to prison to see the Prime Minister and said, Mate, your mob can dig it all up and drop it over the edge of the world. No worries.
Why did he have to go to prison?
We put all our politicians in prison as soon as they're elected, don't you?
Why?
Saves time.
She tried an unrelenting handle.
Damn, and the windows are too high.
The ground trembled. Metal jangled somewhere in the darkness. Dust moved in strange little waves across the floor.
Oh, not again, said Neelette.
Now not only the dust moved. Tiny shapes scuttled across it, flowed around Rincewind's feet, and sped under the locked door.
The spiders are leaving, said Neelette.
Fine by me, said Rincewind.
This time the tremor made the wall creak.
It's never been this bad, Neelette muttered. Find a ladder, we'll give the windows a go.
Above them, a ladder parted company from the wall and folded itself into a metal puzzle on the floor.
This may not seem a good time to ask, said Rincewind, but are you a kangaroo by any chance?
End of side 14. Side 15.
Far above them, metal creaked and went on creaking in a long-drawn wail of inorganic pain. Rincewind looked up and saw the dome of the brewery gently dissolve into 100 falling pieces of glass. And dropping through the middle of it, some of its lamps still burning, the grinning shape of the Rue Beer kangaroo.
Trunky, open up! Neelette yelled.
No,
Rincewind began, but she grabbed him and dragged him, and in front of him was an opening lid. The world went dark. There was wood underneath him. He tapped it very carefully. And wood in front of him. And wood...
Excuse me.
We're inside the luggage.
Why not? That's how we got out of Kangoolie last week. You know, I think it may be a magic box.
Do you know some of the things that have been inside it?
Letitia kept her gin in it. I know that.
Rincewind felt upwards gingerly. Maybe the luggage had more than one inside. He'd suspected as much. Maybe it was like one of those conjurer's boxes where after you'd put a penny in, the drawer miraculously slid around and it had gone. Rincewind had been given one of those as a toy when he was a kid. He'd lost almost $2 before he gave up and threw the thing away. His fingers touched what might have been a lid, and he pushed upwards. They were still in the brewery. This came as some relief, considering where you might end up if you got into the luggage. There was still the bowel-disturbing rumble, punctuated by clangs and tinkles, as bits of rusted metal crashed down with lethal intent. The big kangaroo sign was well alight. In the smoke that rose from it were some pointy hats. That is, the curls swirling and billowing around the holes in the air looked very much like the three-dimensional silhouettes of a group of wizards. Rincewind stepped out of the luggage,
"Oh, no, no, no," he mumbled. "I only got here a couple of months ago. It's not my fault."
"They look like ghosts," said Neelad. "Do you know them?"
"No, but they're all mixed up with these earthquakes and something called the Wet, whatever that was."
"That's just some old story, isn't it?
Anyway, Mr. Wizard, it might have escaped your notice that the place is filling up with smoke. Which way did we come in?" Rincewind looked around desperately. Smoke obscured everything. "Has this place got cellars?" he said.
"Yeah, I used to play mothers and mothers with no lean in them when we were kids. Look for hatches in the floor."
And it was 3 minutes later that the ancient wooden hatch cover in the alley finally gave way under the luggage's insistent pounding. Several rats poured out, followed by Rincewind and Neelet. No one paid them any attention. A column of smoke was rising over the city. Watchmen and citizens were already forming a bucket chain, and men with a battering ram were trying to break open the brewery's main doors.
"We were well out of that," Rincewind observed.
"Oh, boy, yes."
"Hey, what's going on? Where's the bloody water gone?"
The cry came from a man working the handle of a pump out on the street, just as the pump gave a groan and the handle went limp. A watchman grabbed his arm.
"There's another one in the yard over there. Get a wiggle on, mate."
A couple of men tried the other pump. It made a choking noise, spat out a few drops of water and some damp rust, and gave up. Rincewind swallowed.
"I think the water's gone," he said flatly.
"What do you mean, gone?" said Neelet. "There's always water. Huge, great seas of it underground."
"Yes, but it doesn't get filled up much, does it? It doesn't rain here."
"There you go again." She stopped. "What's it you know? You're looking shifty, Mr. Wizard."
Rincewind stared glumly up at the tower of smoke. There were twirling, tumbling sparks in it, rising in the heat and showering down over the city. "Everything will be bone dry," he thought. "It doesn't rain here. Hang on.
How do you know I'm a wizard?" he said.
"It's written on your hat," she said. "Badly."
"You know what a wizard is? This is a serious question. I'm not pushing a prawn."
"Everyone knows what a wizard is. We've got a university full of the useless mongrels."
"And you can show me where this is, can you?"
"Find it yourself."
She tried to stride off through the milling crowd. He ran after her.
"Please don't go. I need someone like you as an interpreter."
"What do you mean? We speak the same language."
"Really? Stubbies here are really short shorts or small beer bottles. How often do newcomers confuse the two?"
Neelet actually smiled.
"Not more than once." "Just take me to this university of yours, will you?" said Rincewind. "I think I can feel a famous last stand coming on."
There was a brief scream of metal overhead, and a windmill fan crashed down into the street. "And we'd better be quick," he added. "Otherwise, all there'll be to drink is beer." The bursar laughed again as a series of little charcoal dots extended their legs, formed up and marched down the stone and across the sand in front of him. Behind him, the trees were already loud with birdsong. And then, sadly, with wizards as well. He could hear the voices in the distance, and while wizards are always questioning the universe, they mainly direct the questions at other wizards and don't bother to listen to the answers.
"Certainly saw no trees when we arrived."
"Probably we didn't see them because of the rain, and the senior wrangler didn't see them because of Mrs. Whitlow. And get a grip on yourself, will you, Dean? I'm sure you're getting young again. No one's impressed. I think I must be just naturally youthful, Arch-Chancellor. Nothing to be proud of there, and please someone stop the senior wrangler getting a grip on himself. Oh, looks like someone's had a picnic." The painter seemed engrossed in his work and paid them no attention at all.
"I'm sure the bursar went this way."
A little red mud coloured a complex curve, and there, as if it had always been there, was a creature with the body of a giant rabbit, the expression of a camel, and a tail that a lizard would be proud of. The wizards appeared round the rock just in time to see it scratch its ears.
"Ye gods, what's that?"
"Some sort of rat," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"Hey, look, Bursa's found one of the locals."
The Dean ambled across to the painter, who was watching the wizards with his mouth open.
"Good morning, fellow. What's that thing called?"
The painter followed the pointing finger.
"Kangaroo," he said.
The voice was a whisper, on the very cusp of hearing, but the ground trembled.
"Kangaroo, eh?"
"That might not be what it's called, sir," said Ponder. "He might just be saying, 'I don't know.'"
"Can't see why not. He looks the sort of chap you find in..."